to AUP Radio, a melting pot of voices and ideas. For our ninth week on air, we bring you Spoiler Alert, Petit Four, and the last episode of The Coda Show.
Welcome to another episode of Spoiler Alert. We're your hosts, Eric.
And Christian.
And unfortunately, Cassidy is not with us today. But, you know, she was busy today. However, we do have a great show for you. So let's start off with some news. So, Frozen, how long ago did that come out, Chris?
A while. Oh, yeah, at least 6 years ago?
No, wait, that can't be right. Right.
I mean,
no, there's no 6 years.
It has to be.
How old were you when it came out?
I was in the seventh grade. I remember they put it up on the screen there.
In the seventh grade.
In my seventh grade classroom.
That means I was in the sixth grade when that came. That's crazy.
Yeah, that is crazy.
Time.
And now they've pulled a sequel out. I don't really know anything about it.
Well, so here's the thing: the sequel is making a lot of money. I have not seen the sequel yet. And to be honest, I'm not really the biggest Disney fan. Like, at least Disney, like, princesses. That's not my thing.
You're not a princess guy.
Yeah, I'm not a princess kind of guy.
Not your scene.
That's not my scene. No, sorry. But I have been to Disneyland, so that's cool. But apparently this new sequel, it's a lot of people are talking about it. There's a lot of buzz and hype around it. And so the reviews seem to be genuinely positive. You know, I think I might see it. I remember when Frozen came out, it was such a big deal, you know?
It was a big deal. I remember Let It Go being ingrained into my life for like at least a year.
I literally hated that song so much.
I actually thought it was a very like good song, but I just like it wasn't like I was going to listen to it in my like spare time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
No, I definitely get that. Like, I think the thing about Frozen that's like so special about it is that it's like Disney's like winter holiday, basically. It's like Disney like took a movie and then they were able to like attach it to the winter. Because like think about it, before Frozen, they didn't really have any like original like winter kind of movies.
I'm trying to think about it. Maybe I'm just not the most like well-versed Disney person.
Yeah,
but
I have a friend who's a huge Disney fan. He's a really big Disney fan.
A Disney fan with like their like Disney winter collection
now
shaking in their boots going
yeah,
like, I can't
exactly.
believe you can't think of this movie.
No, yeah, exactly. If he was listening right now, Henry, if you're listening right now, I'm sorry. But but yeah, no, I'm pretty sure Frozen is the only like winter Disney movie.
And certainly the most high profile
one. So speaking on the amount of money it's made so far, it's made $172 million.
And how long has it been out?
I think a couple weeks at least. I mean, it didn't like just release, but I'm pretty sure that, I mean, that's a lot of money.
I mean,
especially
that's a 2 week haul. That's pretty impressive.
That would be impressive. But unfortunately, I don't know specifically the exact release date of Frozen 2, but there's a lot of buzz around it, a lot of hype around it. You think you're going to see it, Chris?
Probably not in theaters. I'd imagine I'll watch it at one point.
Like a nice background movie.
I'd imagine I'll end up watching it at one point if it comes out.
When you're with your family wearing your ugly sweater, it's like a good movie in the background.
Yeah, exactly, that kind of thing. But I don't know. I can't see myself like going out to a theater to sit down and watch Frozen.
That'd be kind of funny. You'd probably like say you go by yourself. You're like, I'm like the only like dude there that's just like by himself in the theater watching Frozen 2. That'd be pretty funny.
Yeah, that actually reminds me. I saw a tweet about Frozen 2 that was like pictures of Elsa, and it was like, right. OMG, she's so pretty. And someone quoted it and got like 100,000 likes because they just said like, bruh, it's a cartoon.
Yeah, no, that's That's pretty funny. So Frozen 2 is out now. See it or don't see it. But if you have, you know, if you're someone who likes to really get into the spirit of Christmas, or at least the winter and the snow, then this is probably a good movie.
You're a big Disney fan, probably swing by. Of course, all the big Disney fans, I guarantee, have already seen it.
Yeah, they've seen it like three times.
From all the people I know who are like really, really into like Disney animated movies, they don't miss opening weekend.
Yeah. No, definitely. That's a big deal for those people. They really love Disney. I mean, you got to give it props. Disney is like basically like my childhood right there. It's like a lot of Disney.
Yeah, Disney Pixar.
Dude, literally, okay, just think about this. Like Disney has like almost bought up everything that I loved in my childhood. like Marvel and like Spider-Man and now
Star Wars.
Like, oh no. Like they're trying to become like the memory of your childhood, basically, is like what Disney's trying to do.
I remember when Incredibles 2 dropped. That was my childhood.
Oh,
Incredibles
God,
is my favorite animated movie.
I literally forgot Incredibles was...
Because Disney does own Pixar now,
they,
right?
They do own Pixar
And they
now.
Didn't at the time the original dropped.
That's the other thing, too. They bought Pixar. A lot of people forget about that because they always talk about Marvel and, like, Star Wars. But Pixar was a really big company, like, animation company, and they bought that, too. And a lot of people forget that. So, yeah, there's definitely a lot of movies that I watched when I was a kid that Disney now owns, which is pretty crazy.
We're actually talking about another movie that Disney owns today.
This is also another Disney
property, although not one of the biggest ones, not near as big as, Marvel or
Star
Wars.
Unfortunately, I'm a little skeptical. I don't think they're going to make a third movie.
I am a believer in a third movie, but today we're talking about Tron Legacy.
So, Chris, this is like your favorite movie, right?
It's definitely my favorite, if not one of my favorite movies.
I've definitely heard you talk a lot about this movie. You really like this movie.
It's because I think this movie is criminally underrated. Like every time I hear anyone mention this movie, I want to go watch it again.
So the first time I watched this movie, I watched it with you actually, and a couple other of our friends, and we were we were in Amsterdam when we watched that movie. It was pretty crazy.
A very, very, very unique time. I hadn't seen it. I hadn't seen the movie in a while. And we sat down and like, man, that was a fun time.
Let's put this as subtly as possible. This is a movie you'd want to watch while in Amsterdam. Okay. There's lots of great lights and visuals
and colors.
So why do you love this movie so much, Chris?
Honestly, I think this movie is just pure entertainment. And you get to kind of be transported into this unique world that you haven't seen before. And, you know, it doesn't have the most groundbreaking plot, but I think what it does with the world building, and especially the soundtrack, which is by Daft Punk, amazing.
This movie saved Daft Punk's career.
All right, I wouldn't go that far.
Dude, no, seriously, dude. Okay, so they released, this is getting a little bit sidetracked here, but they released their Homework album, which like flopped. Or no, not their Homework album. Their like How to Be Human or something like that. And then they didn't make any music for like multiple years. And then in 2008, they made the Tron soundtrack and they got nominated for a Grammy. And I'm pretty sure, they got nominated
I think
for a Grammy.
2008's a bit early. I'm pretty sure it was 2010.
It was 2010?
Whenever
it came out. My chronology is always so messed up. But whenever the movie came out, they were nominated for a Grammy for that movie. And then later, they produced the most recent album, which was Random Access Memories. So it basically, like, it put them back on the map because after they released that soundtrack, they were touring again. So it was pretty cool.
Speaking of which, I don't know if Daft Punk's ever going to tour again, but I will make the journey if they do,
because
I've heard their concerts are like next level insane.
Dude, they look so cool. Like I've seen the videos.
They do make a cameo in the movie. It's probably the only movie on Earth where those helmets fit in.
Definitely.
I mean, like, can you think of another one where that helmet would look very natural?
They look so like they belong there. Like they literally look so part of the world. It's uncanny.
Anyway, I'm going to give a very brief summary of the movie so everyone knows, you know, what's going on. Pretty much it's a sequel to the original 1982 Tron. I believe it's 1982.
Yeah.
And pretty much the son of the main character from the original, Sam Flynn. His father goes missing, and after 20 years, he ends up in the grid that his father created. It's a digital world, and you know, he finds his dad, and it's a journey about you know, him and his dad trying to get back to the real world. And it's got some spectacular, like, you know, light cycle battles and disc wars and all these kind of arena gladiator-esque games.
Like red versus blue kind of thing going for it.
It's an extremely, like,
it's very
aesthetically pleasing movie. One of the more criticized parts of this movie, which actually wasn't criticized at the time it released, but is kind of criticized now, is... they use CGI to like de-age Jeff Bridges in this movie.
That is noticeable.
And so there's like two characters. There's Flynn, who's actual Jeff Bridges. Like he's actually Kevin Flynn, and he's the real person in a digital space. Mm-hmm. And then there's a clone that he made when he was young named Clue, who doesn't age and he stays young forever. So there's this young version of Jeff Bridges, and the CG is nowadays it doesn't hold up as well as they probably thought
it would.
It's
not really like. I feel like when it released, people would be like, oh, that's pretty good CG, or like, oh, that's pretty cool. They made like Jeff Bridges look like significantly younger. But if you watch the movie now and you look at some of the other things that big budget, especially Disney movies, are capable of doing CG-wise,
it does not
hold up.
Yeah, even Disney since then, in Guardians of the Galaxy 2, they de-aged Kurt Russell, and you cannot tell.
Yeah, like, no, it looks good.
Because normally they have kind of this uncanny valley thing where, like, you know it's fake. Like, you can kind of have it blend in with your mind, but the back of mind, you always know.
Also, so did you see Rogue One?
I did see Rogue One.
So,
Tarkin.
You know, Tarkin actually, I feel like, did not look that good. But Leia is in that movie, too, and she was de-aged. Or, like, I guess, I think they did it the same way they did Tarkin. So, technically, they didn't actually take Carrie Fisher when they did that. I think they just did it based off of modeling. But she looks really, like, young in that. Like, she looks really like the original character. So it's pretty crazy what they can do now. Yeah.
Yeah, so I will say that's probably one of the worst aspects of the movie is that you can't really span that uncanny valley with de-aged Jeff Bridges. But I think the rest of the movie more than makes up for it. I mean, this movie is fun from start to finish.
Yeah, this movie is really fun.
I mean, and it's got, I wouldn't say phenomenal acting. I think Garrett Hedlund, who plays Sam Flynn, think he's good. And this is where my opinion of the movie kind of diverges from normal. I don't actually think he's really the main character of this movie. Like, he's the protagonist in the sense that he's the character we see the most and follow, but I think his character is more used as a catalyst to see the world that they're shaping, and that the kind of the world of the grid is the main character of the movie.
So let me ask you, why do you think this movie works in that sense? Because, like, there's a lot of movies that try to do stuff like this that are also, like, people look at it and they're like, oh, this is kind of cheesy, or like, oh, this is over the top. But, like, Tron doesn't really feel that way. So why do you think it works?
I think it honestly works because, you know, we get to see this world from kind of an outsider perspective. We don't know really that much about it because it's very different from the grid in the original Tron. In the original Tron, they had the master control program who was controlling everything. And that's not really how it is in this movie. But what happens is, you know, you jump in and it's straight into the action in this world when you when Sam enters the grid. You get pulled straight from him pushing the button and entering the grid, straight into him in Disc Wars, you know, getting his armor.
Oh, yeah, that scene. Okay,
and
yeah.
So they really, I remember that. They don't spend a lot of time warming up up the grid. They throw you right in. And if the sequence from, like, Disc Wars to the light cycle battle to escaping in, like, the Outlands when Korra kind of rescues him, that sequence, like, I cannot take my eyes off this screen because it's so visually pleasing, and it's got very good action.
There's
also
no breaks in the action from that point until, the movie. So let's talk about, like, the pacing of the movie a little bit. It opens up. I feel like it opens up. It's kind of exciting, but it kind of gets slow too. The beginning is, like, definitely a slower part of the movie
because the beginning starts with after Sam's dad goes missing. He you know, he pulls off this like heist at his dad's old company.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. It's that's the part of the movie that I think is really silly, because then he runs onto some some catwalk really high above the building, like really high above the street. And then this guy comes up to him and is like, he's a security guard. And he's like, what does he say? He's like, oh, what are you robbing or something like that? And then he's like, oh, it's my company or something like that. And then he jumps. He jumps.
Yeah, he does a base jump off the building, which by the way, I would like. I'm trying to remember Joseph Kaczynski, I think, is the director. Dude, that is not how base jumping works.
You should go tell him.
Now, that kind of base jump would be possible, but not in the way that he did it.
No, it was that part of the movie. The opening part of the movie is definitely a little bit of the weaker part of the movie. But once they get into the grid, it's really, really cool.
Yeah,
and I had not seen this movie before watching it with you, which was only 2 months ago or something like that. And I always thought this movie was kind of cheesy, just because I heard that's what people said. And I'm like, oh yeah, Tron, Tron, all right, whatever. But then when I watched that movie, it was actually pretty crazy. It was a pretty crazy movie. It's really, really underrated, is a good way to put it.
And one of the things of this movie that I think is very, very impressive is the set design.
Yeah,
because
the set design is cool.
You're in a very, CG heavy world, which, by the way, even though Jeff Bridges' CG doesn't hold up, the world of The Grid does.
Yeah.
It's extremely impressive.
But
some of the sets, Flynn's apartment is all practical.
Yeah.
The end of line club. All practical.
Yeah, end of line club. And yeah, that's crazy. I actually did not know that those were practical effects.
Yeah,
I mean, yeah, that makes sense that his apartment would be practical. Yeah. But
they lifted up.
Yeah,
because they had this light floors. These white tiles of light that make up the entire floor. So basically, they made it with this big elevated platform. And they built the whole thing on that, and you can watch some behind the scenes footage, and it's really cool to see that kind of thing exist in the real
world.
That's
pretty crazy, to be honest. That was all practical. Yeah.
Another thing that's all practical in the movie are the costumes.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah. Even the lights are practical. But the part of the costume which kind of spans into the CG realm is the way they power the suits in the movie is the battery is in the disc on the back.
Oh, that's cool. So you mean practically when they power the lights of the suits, it's the people's discs, right? The actors' discs on their back have the battery in them that powers the suit. That's pretty cool.
Obviously, in the movie, they'd have to take the discs off, and you can't actually.
Right. No, yeah, that's really cool. Yeah, that's this movie has got so the idea of robots and or not really robots, but AI in a sense, I don't know, the way I viewed it was that Sam was a person, and the way it was meant to be built was that Tron was the person who's supposed to be the AI that helps him. If you think about it in a game, and then Clue is supposed to be the AI who is against him.
I don't necessarily think that's how it works, because I'm guessing you haven't seen the original Tron.
No, I have not seen the original
Tron. It's more because in the original Tron, the actual program Tron was a replica of one of Flynn's friends in real life, who was basically a defense program for the system. So when Flynn made a new grid, which was the grid we see in Tron Legacy, he brought Tron, the program, over from the old grid into the new one, and he created Clue to help him build a system, where I think he put it as all information could be free. I don't know what that actually means, but...
Yeah,
Jeff Bridges says some really weird stuff in this movie.
Yeah, Jeff Bridges his performance is pretty funny.
It's really funny because he's this god who is also a hippie.
He's this powerless god. He's a god, but clearly he doesn't have, he has no control over the world.
He's not omnipotent, but he does have clear abilities above the programs. He can.
Yeah.
Like, that's he can that's create another things interesting that about they this. Can't.
Yeah, is that it's sort of like the idea that his own creations have sort of taken control in a little bit, like in a sense that they've taken control of his world. And that's like the main plot, is that they're trying to get out. Like, Clue is trying to, like, pull an army out of the world to conquer our world or whatever. But something I thought was kind of silly, and one of our friends pointed this out to me, is that there's this one scene where Clue is like talking to all of his like programs, right? But like, they're supposed to be programmed. So, like what's the... Yeah, he's, like, giving a moral...
He's like hyping himself
yeah, he's
up.
Literally...
He's giving, like, this whole speech to these programs who I don't think actually have a choice
Dude,
in the
it's
matter.
Like, it's like, okay, listen to this. It's like if a drone pilot got all of these drones and, like, lined them up in front of him and then gave them a speech about how they're going to conquer the world. It's like, they can't hear you. They're drones. Like, okay. It doesn't make sense.
I do think, in reality, the soldiers do have, like, they have personalities and consciousness. But they're not... They're not just robots, but they are, like, because I think each program in the grid is given, like, a purpose, and what he's doing is he's taking, like, the random ones off the streets, and he's repurposing them to be soldiers.
I just love, Chris, how you, like, know so much about Tron.
If you just tuned in, this is Spoiler Alert on AEP Radio, brought to you by WRP. It's 9:20.
I remember.
Hey, man, I'm a big fan of this movie.
Okay, so one of us, when we were watching this movie, one of us asked Chris, hey, Chris, is there wind in Tron? And within, like, less than a second, he's just like, yes. Like, he doesn't even think about it.
I mean,
it.
You
like,
see...
Yes, okay, there's wind.
The fact of the matter is, I've seen the movie a lot, and you see wind in the movie at one point.
Dude, no, it's funny. It's like asking, like, oh, yeah, are there politics in the Tron world? Are there, like, social hierarchies?
Obviously.
Well, yeah, of course, man. It's just like any other world.
Anyway, so back on to the movie. I think some of the back to
our movie here.
One of the parts of this movie I think turns it from a good movie into one of my favorite movies is, like, in the middle of the action pieces, Daft Punk's score fits so perfectly.
Yeah, it fits in very well.
Like, there's this scene towards, it's sort of the climax of the movie where they're making sort of a mad dash for the portal to get back to the real world, and they're getting chased by jets that have, like, light ribbons Clue.
Yeah.
And got the part of the score during that scene is just awesome.
Yeah, like, no, Daft Punk definitely outdid themselves in this movie. This is probably one of the best soundtracks for a sci-fi movie besides, like, Blade Runner,
like,
honestly,
of all time, like, Star Wars, Blade Runner.
Yeah, and, like, Tron, literally. And if you don't, if, like, really take away what you will from this movie, there are parts that are silly, but there is one thing that is usually universally agreed about this movie, is that the score of this movie is phenomenal. It really helps the movie a lot. And honestly, I would say just watch the movie for the score alone. Like, it fits in with the scene so well. You know, it's definitely the highlight of this movie, I would say.
And another sort of, like, underappreciated aspect, I think the best performance of the movie, acting-wise, for a main character at least, is Olivia Wilde as Cora.
Oh, yeah, Olivia Wilde.
She's very good at playing this sort of naive character who doesn't quite get how everything works, but... I mean, she just absolutely nails it. And
she's good in this.
If I were to include side characters in best performance, it would definitely be Michael Sheen as Caster. That dude does not care about anything.
Yeah, that was
doing air guitars.
Yeah,
on his
dude, that was so funny.
And
he's like, hit them again, and then he, like, does some, like, little, like, air guitar or, like, I don't know. He, like, takes his stick and he goes, like, woo. It's a really funny scene.
He's hilarious.
He is really
role.
Good. But in the end of line club scene. But yeah, so that's sort of, what would you rate Tron?
That I'm going to give it a 15 out of 10. In reality,
out of 10.
This movie does have flaws. I just think it is so overwhelmingly fun.
I'm going to give it a solid 15 out of 10.
Obviously, 15. This movie is not perfect. We've rated more flaw, like, we've done more flawless movies on this show.
Definitely.
But I think this movie is so overwhelmingly fun
this
that
movie,
I don't care about its flaws.
This movie kind of goes back to that thing we were talking talking about earlier about like Disney is that like they don't really care about whether or not they're like producing Oscar movies. It's more about like making movies that are fun, like Frozen or like Star Wars movies. And Tron definitely is like very much fits that mold. It is a fun movie. It is a very, very fun movie.
Also, yeah. final note though, there have been rumors that a third Tron is being made. I am very hopeful.
Okay.
Can't get my hopes up too high.
I don't want to squash your dreams. I don't want to do it, but I feel like there's some other priorities out there that they have.
I feel like Disney's probably going to wrap up Star Wars before they get along because they're kind of the same market share.
But do you think? Yeah, that's true. But do you think there would be like? Do you think there's enough hype around Tron or like enough of a community around Tron to make another movie?
I think this movie has kind of turned into a cult movie.
Yeah.
Because
so you would say you're part of the cult.
Oh, absolutely. One of those things, because that's actually what happened with the original Tron. The original Tron was a box office bomb, but became a cult hit. And I think that's actually what's happening with the sequel, because when Disney Plus dropped, they put the original like 1982 Tron trailer on the Disney YouTube page. And if you read the comments for that, it is nothing but saying, we want a third movie. We want a third movie. When's the third movie coming
out? Yeah, but these are like people who like go to that YouTube video and like, find it down.
It's also a very highly watched video Disney's
channel.
I do think there would be support because the last one made 400 and something million.
There's definitely a lot of potential for a third movie, and I feel like Disney could see that there's enough of a fan base to make a third Tron movie. So that being said, I would rate Tron probably. Honestly, I know it's not that good of... Well, it's not, like, a bad movie, but it's not, like, as good of a movie as some of the other ones we've talked about, but that was, like, watching Tron was one of the most, like, fun things I did that whole month. So I'd probably say, like, an 8 or a 9. Probably a 9. I'd give it a 9 out of 10. Yeah,
that's what I like
9.
To hear.
Yeah, solid 9.
On to today's movie recommendation.
Yes, so do you have a movie for us today? Chris?
I do. It is, technically it's a documentary, but it's Free Solo. It's a Nat Geo documentary.
Yes, that's a pretty cool documentary.
Because me and Eric both do some rock climbing a little bit.
Yes, we are rock climbers. Hit us up if you want to come
If you want to go rock climbing,
yes.
Find us in the Amex
Cafe. Come find us somewhere at AUP. We'll go climbing with you.
Free Solo is a documentary about Alex Honnold, who became the first person to ever free solo El Capitan in Yosemite National Park.
And that means, for anyone who doesn't know, without a rope.
Yeah. Free Solo is like a solo climb. You have no gear, so if you fall, you die.
Yeah, you totally die. You're dead.
You know, and a lot of people, you know, who haven't heard of El Capitan, it's a cliff in Yosemite that is 3,000 feet.
Just look
of
at your Apple
granite.
Background. the default Mac background is El Capitan.
He also, I don't know if he was the first, but he also has completed a successful free solo of Half Dome, which is another mountain in Yosemite that's not quite as tall, but still a ridiculously impressive climb that I would die trying.
Yeah, it's definitely a really good movie. It's also on Disney Plus. You can watch that, and it's really well shot. And there's a lot of hype around it.
It's a beautiful movie. Oh, and when you see the final sort of scaling of the mountain, the music is awesome.
Yeah,
so I'd say
it's
definitely
got a good soundtrack.
Give it a watch. Very interesting. If you're faint of heart, probably don't. But that's my.
I mean, he doesn't die.
He doesn't
that's
die.
That's not spoilers. Like this is a very well known story.
If he died, they would not have made this movie.
Yeah, exactly.
But
it is a good movie. It's a really good movie. It's impressive to see his feats. And you know, I think it's cool. It's definitely cool.
Anyway, I think that might be it for this week.
Yeah. So thank you for tuning in with us. Unfortunately. We were one man short today, but still, we talked about Tron, which is
the best movie of all time.
Yes, we alluded
Don't
to that,
me.
And yeah, we followed through. Tron, go watch Tron. It's a great movie, amazing movie. It's a really fun time.
And watch Free Solo.
Watch Free Solo.
But we will we'll see you all next week.
All right,
this has been Christian
and Eric signing out. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello. hello, and welcome back to Petit Four, where we give you bite-sized information about fun or interesting happenings that took place this week. Who would like to start off today?
I guess I can go first.
All right.
It's me, Savannah, again.
Good morning.
The editor-in-chief.
Good evening, actually.
Unfortunately, I don't have a fun story to start off with today, so sorry, everyone. But I read an article from France 24, France 24, that was about femicide in France. This weekend, there was a rally that was held in Paris where many women showed up to show their alliance against femicide in France. And it was something I had heard the term before, but I didn't know the exact definition. And it's a woman who is killed by her partner or former partner is femicide.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's a growing issue here in France. From what I understand, there's been 116 women so far year that have been killed. That was reported by Agence France-Presse. And France 24 is actually, they hosted a program called Focus, where they spoke to one of these domestic violence victims who did survive an attack from her partner. She escaped her violent ex-husband while he tried to throw her out of a window in front of her children.
Oh my goodness.
And apparently there's been a lot of just dismissal by the French government with domestic violence cases towards women, which is why this rally on Saturday was such a big deal. But I mean, this is, and I've heard this before from other people too, that especially women who are reporting rape or assault are quite often dismissed, especially in the reporting of it. And so even some of these numbers that we're seeing may not be totally accurate. There's probably plenty more out there. I think it did say that marital violence affects 220,000 French women every year. And the number is probably greater than that because of the lack of reports, because women are being dismissed for this, which is something that, I mean, especially with the Me Too movement in the U.S. is, I mean, it's still very common, but it's not as bad as I think it is here, from what I'm understanding.
Oh, yeah. I have a lot of opinions on this subject.
Yeah. It says that France does have one of the highest domestic violence rates in all of Europe.
Wow. That's shocking.
That's impressive in the worst kind of way. I don't know if you guys have seen around Paris tags on buildings, on...
Yeah, I've definitely seen those.
It's written all over Paris. If you pay attention, you'll find it pretty much everywhere.
Yeah, they're on bridges, on the side of buildings. I have been seeing them, and I was wondering what that was in, what it had to do with. And it was, this growing group here in Paris of women who are allies and rallying for this cause.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is important because it's something that, I mean, after living here for 3 years, I wasn't even privy to.
That's so scary. Especially, you know, in the comfort of your own home, to think that someone, you know, that you care for is, you know, physically attacking you. I mean, this isn't even about like mental abuse. This is about physical abuse,
yeah,
too.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think they're both absolutely horrifying, yeah. But
Like I said, I think that number, that 220,000, is probably so much greater than we actually expect.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely.
It's much lower, right?
Well, greater. There's probably higher, more incidences than have been reported.
Yeah.
So,
to that point, because you said that France has the highest, is it the highest or among the highest rates?
It is the highest in Europe.
To that point, I would just like to share my personal view briefly. I have been very impressed in the negative sense over the past years living in France, because it's been 4 years that I've lived here now, and a year before I started studying. So that year was when I was really in French society, let's say. I was really shocked when I first arrived to see how in France the culture just allows people to sweep issues under the carpet, to joke about everything, because the theory is, yeah, but if we can't joke about this, then we can't joke about anything anymore. So they make jokes about everything that we would consider inappropriate in PC culture in the US, but also just not to address major issues. They don't talk about these things. You know, in the US perhaps we talk a little bit too much about it, and it's even a burden to citizens to know, to discuss
discuss so regularly the issues that plague that country. But in France, I honestly think there's not enough discussion.
No, yeah, definitely not.
Mm, I completely agree.
For me, having lived here 3 years, and this is the first time I'm hearing about this movement, you know?
Yeah. 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 All right.
I would love to follow that, actually, Savannah, because it's...
Absolutely.
It's interesting that you brought that up, and I assume the reason why is because today is the International Day to End Violence Against Women, Monday, 25th of November.
I did not know that, but that is... I mean, this goes...
Great coincidence.
This is a great coincidence, then.
I'm assuming that was their news angle for publishing that statistic.
Mm. Absolutely, yes.
So I actually went to the UNESCO General Conference last week. It's been running since the 12th of November until the 27th, so it's ending on Wednesday. But I got to go only on Friday because I had a lot to do at uni. Anyway, sidebar. I went to listen to the launch of the publication Reporting on Violence Against Women and Girls, which is a handbook for journalists. And it was put together by the Canadian Commission to UNESCO, the Permanent Delegation of Canada to UNESCO, and France Média Monde. This panel featured Virginie Hertz, who's a reporter at France 24, and she's one of the hosts of a France 24 show called Actuelle, which is a play on words of current, actuelle, and elle, which means she or they, in the feminine. So she already does a lot of, I guess, gender-based reporting. And in 2018, she received a distinguished UN prize in name of Ricardo Ortega, a Spanish journalist. Fiona, you want to correct me on that pronunciation?
No, it was very good.
Oh, thank you. Gracias.
Gracias.
That was ironic. A Spanish journalist who was killed while reporting on the ground in Haiti in 2004. So the prize rewards the best media coverage of UN actions. And Virginie Hertz gained this prize because she was awarded by the Association of Press Correspondents of the UN for her show Femme Casque Bleu, l'ONU promue la mixité, which means women in blue helmets. The UN is promoting, I don't know how you'd say mixity, but it means equal participation of women and men. So anyway, she is definitely a distinguished journalist in her field. And she led this panel, and the conversation was very interesting because they spoke maybe for 30 or 40 minutes about how these various commissions, delegates, and then France Média Monde worked together to produce this manual, which is published in English and French for its initial publication. But then they opened the floor to questions or comments. I think they wanted questions, but they got a lot of comments. And it was really, really heartening to see how many people wanted to take the mic. It was people all across the spectrum of age, race, and also gender. And everyone was there to speak up on behalf of women. It was talking about perhaps the organizations, the NGOs for which they were working, which were contributing to this fight against violence, gender-based violence, as it's known. And a lot of people spoke to the importance of having this kind of a manual. And so I just want to briefly give you guys a look into what it covered. There are 10 specific themes, from cyberbullying, early marriages or child marriages, female genital mutilation, forced marriages, so on and so forth, sexual harassment, so-called honor crimes. So they cover a lot of different topics, and then they discuss how journalists should approach these topics, in which context is it better to have a certain type of interviewer, in which context do you need to use what type of words. And I think this is very relevant to your point, Savannah, about not having heard about this kind of thing. Femicides are often labeled as crime passionnel, crimes of passion, or domestic issues. You know, they're not labeled as a real murder or assault, and that obviously contributes to the how the psyche digests this kind of news. So this is a really exciting publication, and there are people also from different organizations who spoke to that and expressed their interest in having it translated into Arabic and so on. So that was a really heartening moment, and just my thanks to the team at UNESCO for letting me slip in and witness that.
Yeah, that's really, really awesome that that's been published, and I would actually like to take a look at that at some point.
All right.
Yeah.
Very exciting.
I mean,
I'll go to my point, but just I've been doing a lot of research on the linguistics of journalism and how we perceive everything through, you know, the words that we're given. And of course, to have a better vocabulary, a more reliable syntax with which to work with in addressing these is definitely a fantastic addition to the journalistic corpus. So to go in a little bit of a different direction, but to follow with the whole theme of protesting, over the weekend in Venice, there were a series of protests, obviously against the floods, although you can't really protest the nature of it. They were protesting the impact of giant cruise ships specifically on the environment and on how the waves were contributing to the erosion of Venice itself, which I wasn't aware of before, but it makes sense. But so that was a huge thing, and it was called Venice Resist. And I don't know, I haven't been there yet, and it's of course very disappointing to see the effects of climate change on such fantastic monuments, and you just wonder how many are going to last and for how long we're going to have them until, you know, they all succumb to this disaster.
I mean, it's such a magnificent, like, it's such a beautiful city, and it's definitely been overrun by tourists, and, you know, but I mean, a lot of locals, their argument too is that they need tourists in order to survive, because that's been their source of income for the past, you know, God knows how many years. So it's a, you know, kind of a double-edged sword. It's like, do we let them come in? Do we put a tax on the tourists that want to come in? It's just, yeah.
Because it's gotten to a point where Venetians are even being driven out of their homes.
Yeah.
Because they can no longer afford to live within the city.
You've got so big companies like Airbnb. You've got all these, you know, big conglomerates who are kind of taking over, so.
If you're just joining us, this is Petit Four on AEP Radio, brought to you by WRP. It's 9:40.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting to hear the climate aspect of that. I know we had Ivani from Climate Conversation speak last week with a PhD.
Professor Piani.
About the effects of global warming and specifically with the ocean, because he has a PhD in oceanography. But it was the floods, the Venice floods were brought up, and he said that it is more than just the weather patterns and the currents that are affecting that. And I think you're right. Like this, it is these like cruise ships and coming in and everything. It is pretty wild. And I think they can still hopefully manage tourism, but without having such like the ships coming in and everything, which is just kind of wild.
All right, Elise, for you.
All right, so I will be the last one to go for today, but I don't know if you heard, but the Victoria's Secret fashion show has been canceled.
Woo!
Yeah, I know. Really? I thought that was actually quite exciting.
For this session?
I think it's going to be canceled. You know, they haven't really come up with a new plan. I know, it's absolutely insane.
Because wasn't it actually just canceled last year? Like, they just didn't do it?
No, they did do it. They did do it. Yeah. Okay. They did do it last year. The show was essentially created in 1995, so it's been running for quite a while. And it's really interesting to look at, you know, the numbers of viewership. Now mainstream TV, they're having a lot of trouble to kind of promote the show and stuff. And so they definitely had to stop. And especially nowadays with, you know, the Me Too movement and all these, you know, empowering women who are coming out and kind of speaking out. I definitely don't think that the image they're trying to portray, or that they've been trying to portray for so many years, is kind of, you know, I think people are definitely over it. And so I don't know, I find this very exciting, but I don't know, how does everyone feel?
Yeah, I did see a headline on this where it did mention that they like had officially canceled it, because I know it's been like that's been in the conversation that for a while that it was going to be canceled. And somebody tweeted it or commented and said like, because the whole thing was, I think their former CEO who did step down or resign after like some
she had
comments were made.
It was outrageous. It was actually the CEO of Victoria's Secret who had to step down. It was the CMO, Ed Razek, who made the extremely controversial
chief marketing officer.
Thank you
for those.
And basically he said that he would never hire a transgender model, and that the brand, you know, isn't kind of like basically diversity. They say they celebrate it, but, you know, clearly in a statement, and he actually had to step down back in August.
Yeah, he said something about it like not living up to the fantasy
of the brand.
And somebody tweeted it, and they're like, oh, I guess having to cancel the show isn't working for you.
Right.
I mean, a long time coming, honestly.
Right, right. And I mean, even their viewership, the numbers from, you know, back in 2016, it's about 7 million viewers. Business Insider did this whole report. And this past year, they only had 3.27 million viewers.
Yeah. Beam.
So that's half.
All right. Well, we will wrap up on that note. Again, today is the International Day to End Violence Against Women. Mm-hmm. And so this was a good segment on which to end. And yeah. Just for those of you listening, if you haven't noticed, if you've been listening since the start of the season, if you haven't noticed over the past 9 weeks, AUP Radio is run entirely by four amazing women. I mean, if I'm counting myself. Aww. But anyway, my three amazing team members. So thank you. I want to take this opportunity to thank you all because it's our second to last episode.
Aww,
and
it's been a great
pleasure. Thank you.
Working under you has been incredible. Yeah.
We'll keep up the fight for what's right. And have a great week, everyone.
Hi, and welcome back to our final installment of The Coda Show. Thanks so much for your loyal season of listening. I'm one of your hosts, Joe Chaffetz, also here with...
With Kid Charlemagne making his return, also known as Joe, if you aren't familiar with me already. And for our final show, we have a very special guest. It's my dear friend Matthew from Adelaide. Me and Matthew played in a band together. Matthew, would you like to introduce yourself?
Thanks for having me. My name is Matthew. I don't have a last name. Joe and I have go a long way back in Australia. And I met other Joe just the other day, and we've hit it off like a house on fire. So I'm very blessed to be here.
So me and Matthew, I think this is going to be an interesting show, considering me and Matthew's cultural background, history. Shared cultural background, and a common appreciation for music, I suppose.
If at any point either of them pause, it's because they're self-censoring their innate Australian need to drop an obscenity.
Yeah, we're going to try our best.
I do apologize.
And just before we start, another a bit of a promotion. If listeners remember Jürgen from last week, his band, The Vivians, who our friend, our co-host Oliver, who will also be playing with him in his band. And this show is on December the 7th at 8 p.m. at 37 Rue Rochechouart.
I think that's 38.
38 Rue Rochechouart. I'm sorry. Great. Yeah.
So go and see that. Go and support your local musicians. Go and support the host and guest of this show, as you should constantly.
And speaking of local music and communities that form around music, Joe, would you mind introducing our topic?
Right. Absolutely. So what we're going to be talking about today is the music that people party to and subcultures as they pertain to the places where we gather and hang out and have a good time, and the music that goes along with that, and how the music and the subcultures inform each other. What are the similarities across cultures? What are the differences? And our panel today is 1.5 Americans and 1.5 Australians, with Kid Charlemagne, of course, embodying that beautiful melange of Amer-Australian.
Yeah, indeed. But my heart is in Australia, and I don't know anything about American music. Oh, I guess I know a little bit, but...
Steely Dan?
Yeah. Well, but yeah, anyways.
For all intents and purposes.
For all intents and purposes, I'm an Australian.
Yeah, okay. All right, so I guess let's kick it off with a little bit about y'all's hometown, where and when you guys would get lit with your friends, and what kind of music you guys were listening to at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, Joe and I both come from Adelaide in South Australia, which is a population of 1 million, including the outer regions. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, when we started playing music, it was quite the same as lots of bands, where we used to go to pubs, which are like bars, really. I'm not sure if pub's a global term.
No, it can be understood.
Yeah, and then, you know, bands played there most nights, and we just kind of got into pub rock, which I guess the genre would be called. And then, we just formed a band because it was easy to play at pubs.
Yeah, and I think being a part of that pub rock sort of scene feels kind of special, because it feels, I think going to pubs and seeing live music is sort of the has been historically like a very large pastime for the average Australian. And, you know, I think unlike cities in Europe, Adelaide doesn't really have a big like techno big club party scene, but rather we'd go to our humble little pubs and see some, you know, however all, you know, people bashing out punk rock or whatever.
Do you think that's a reflection of the differences between the European and Australian characters?
I don't know. It's hard to say. I think in Australia, pub rock has been really popular for such a long time, because I think it sort of has been the natural development of musical taste. Also in the sense that I think Australia wasn't really exposed to lots of different kinds of music before, you know, the internet you know, became this platform where music could be just sort of you know, streamed universally. Like, I can't imagine people in the 70s really listening to much you know, French music.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously there was a lot of American music that came over,
right.
but for the most part, you know, Australia has its roots in, you know, rock music. I mean, okay. Think like AC/DC,
yeah.
You know,
right. Was,
so do you think that's a kind of like self-propelled, like Australia is at this point of autarky in terms of their music consumption? Is it's all you've got sufficient domestic production to only consume Australian music, or would you say that there's like a pretty big influence from maybe not the whole world, but specific countries? Like, if anyone dominated the field, would it be like Great Britain, which there's a lot of political and economic ties to? And
I think in England, with the rise of the Kinks, and one of our first big Australian exports in music, I guess, was the Easy Beat, which was essentially a copy of the Kinks. And that was, you know, the big takeoff, I think early 60s,
mm-hmm.
as well. And that was kind of the Britpop, mm-hmm. type stuff. And I think since then, Australia in most art forms, we've kind of taken things from England and adapted it to our culture. And I think now, like you said, even though there are lots of great electronic producers and stuff in the country, we like to keep it Australian, and we like to keep it pub rock because it's kind of ours.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I definitely, in my interaction with Australian music, which I have to say has been like disproportionately large for the population of Australia, you are hugely represented in American music consumption. People that come to mind are, I know you have some enmity towards him, but Chet Faker is fairly big in the United States. Flume is also very big. Taku has quite a following. And then you have, of course, the breakout hits of Gautier and Kylie Minogue, all of those people.
Yeah, no, there's definitely been like a fairly big emergence of pop music in Australia, which I think has been a very recent development. I mean, that's not to discount the influence that a person we were listening to fairly recently had, Kylie Minogue.
Yeah,
she's absolutely great.
She's amazing.
She's biggest export.
Yeah. Something.
Yeah.
It's great. She's pop terrific. Music there.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, and how could we possibly neglect our producer is chiding us right now? Tame Impala.
Kevin
and of course,
Parker.
Yeah.
Kevin Parker.
I mean, we could do a whole show about Tame Impala.
I mean, that's really quite interesting culturally, because that was kind of the birth of the Perth music scene.
Right, yeah.
And
who
even
else is out of there? San Cisco, a couple others.
Yeah, but I mean, I have a problem with the term Perth music scene. I think people have this idea of the Perth music scene just because, you know, Tame Impala has this circle of affiliates that, mm-hmm. you know, they associate with. I mean, bands like Pond,
Nick Avery,
like Cam Avery, who you may or may not be familiar with. But they're definitely, I think, Tame Impala definitely had its started like a psych music.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people now seem to affiliate Australia with some sort of psychedelic scene, which I think is, for the greater part solely attributed to the rise of Tame Impala.
But what about like Conan Moccasin?
Well, he's from New Zealand.
Oh,
in fact,
oh my.
Don't get mixed up.
Oh my, come on,
really,
man.
Faux pas. Yeah. Here. Oh, I'm so sorry.
But the thing about Tame Impala is that if you listen to, I think lots of people wouldn't be as familiar with their earlier stuff as they are with like Lonerism or Currents, but they started as a band called the Dee Dee Dums. It was like Kevin Parker and Dom Simper, the really quiet guy in Tame Impala. But they, if you listen to their stuff, they are like pure...
They're pub rock.
They're pub rock.
Okay.
They sound pub rock.
Well, what do you... Let me ask, what do y'all play when you're not at a live music? And I don't mean play as in like, what do you personally as musicians play? Like, let's look at ourselves as listeners for a second. Mm-hmm. What do you listen to when you're with your friends, not in a pub?
Well,
is it still pub rock?
No, it's not. It's not. And I wouldn't say as much as I love Australian music and I'm proud to be an Australian, I don't love what could be characterized as like pub rock. Like, I'm not a massive AC/DC fan.
No.
Okay. As sacrilegious as that is. But I love, you know, like the culture that emerged from like Tame Impala's influence. Yeah. But when it comes down to like, you know, the two guitars, bass and drums performing on this like a grimy stage playing, you know, distorted guitars, like that's not something I really get down to. But in the scene of a, when you're talking about going out for going on a night out to listen to some music, that's the kind of stuff I'd listen to, and I can get down to it if I have a few beers in me or whatever.
Okay.
But when I'm, you know, just chilling at home, it's not the kind of thing that I would listen to.
All right, so here in France, when we go out, and this is probably not representative because it's our friend group specifically, but when we go out and we're going out like to dance specifically, it's almost always four on the floor techno because that's what's being played, right?
I don't think that's really hit Australian shores. I mean, like, there's definitely pockets in Sydney and Melbourne that are very influenced by German techno, but I'm seeing a rise in American hip hop as being a big driver for teenage culture in Australia.
That makes a lot of sense. That comes through like Flume, probably the biggest electronic artist in Australia. Can we say that?
I think that's fair.
Yeah, okay. So Flume is the biggest electronic artist in Australia, and he has like never once that I've heard used a four on the floor in a way that it couldn't also be used in hip hop. Like, he is not making like techno based, house based dance music. He's making hip-hop based. And in interviews I've seen of him, he says that he just loves the reaction of crowds to, like, the American hip-hop beat because it's just a different kind of getting down than the four-on-the-floor techno kind of derived beat.
Yeah, like, it's kind of weird. I'm seeing a lot of young music makers, I guess, in Adelaide, to bring it back to Adelaide, making electronic music kind of solely based on that American hip-hop stuff, like a lot of like old school 90s artists and stuff like that. And it's quite interesting because we've seemed to have bypassed a lot of the European techno which kind of preceded that, and I'm not too sure why, but I mean, I love that type of music. You know, so I think the electronic music coming out of Australia is definitely growing, and it's pretty good.
Yeah. Well, I for one can't get enough of this stuff. I love it, and unfortunately, that was the shortest 15 minutes of my life, and we're gonna have to wrap it up here and ask you listeners to come back next semester at the end of January, maybe start of February. Thank you so much, Matt, for coming.
Thank you for having me, Joe.
Before you leave, Matt, would you like to spout out a couple seconds of shameless self-promotion?
Yeah, sure. I make music under the guise of Albert. You can find me on Instagram at the handle IamNot_Albert. Hopefully working with Non-Joe Major on some music soon as well. So that should be interesting,
That'll be coming to you at the beginning of next year. So
there we go.
Once again, this has been The Coda Show. Thank you so much for listening in. And catch our good friends Jürgen Hecker and Oliver Henry at their concert on 38 Rue de Rochechouart on December 7th at 8 p.m. All right, this has been Joe.
And Kid Charlemagne.
Signing off.
Peace.
Radio is produced by Savannah Rowe, Fiona McMurray, Elise Chauvel, and Isabel Guigui. That's me. Our theme music is by Jill Chavitz and Oliver Henry of Chateau Russe. That's all for tonight on AUP Radio. Tune in tomorrow for more, and have a great night.